What you are about to hear is the actual, on-the-spot recording of the investigation of the civil rights problem and ghetto life in Cleveland, Ohio, as conducted by the United States Civil Rights Commission during the first week of April 1966. Here now is the beginning of the first session.
I am John Hanna of East Lansing, Michigan, the chairman of the commission, and I should like to introduce to you the members of the commission. My immediate right is Eugene Patterson of Atlanta, Georgia, editor of the Atlanta Constitution and the vice chairman of the commission. At my immediate left is Dean Irwin N. Griswold of Cambridge, Massachusetts, dean of the Harvard University School of Law. And seated next to Dean Griswold is Mrs. Frankie Muse Freeman of St. Louis, Missouri, who is associate general counsel of the St. Louis Housing and Land Clearance Authority. And at my far left is Dr. Robert S. Rankin of Durham, North Carolina, professor of political science at Duke University. On the right, next to Commissioner Patterson, is the Reverend Father Theodore M. Hesburgh of South Bend, Indiana, the president of Notre Dame University.
Five major problem areas developed during the investigation. They are housing, health and welfare services, education, employment, and police-community relations. Each of these areas calls for deeper individual study in itself. However, references in the investigation are overlapping because the problems themselves, as encountered by real people in real situations, are overlapping. You'll hear the voices of experts from the governor and the mayor to the poorest slum dweller. The latter being the best expert on life in the inner city. Both Governor James A. Rhodes of Ohio and Mayor Ralph Locher of Cleveland expressed the deepest interest of the state and city in the poverty problem.
We would point out that one of the greatest enemies of democracy and individual freedom is poverty in the midst of prosperity. Poverty is the enemy in any community where civil rights have not been fully achieved.
Your presence here today indicates your concern and your desire to help us in our efforts to build a great city.
One of the first startling revelations came from a housewife who dwells in the Huff area. She comments on pictures of her living accommodations.
This is my bathroom. The bathroom is on two levels. This is step you step up to use the face bowl in the bath. I mean in the toilet. This is my bathtub. The reason is water's in here. It takes from 3 to 5 days for this water to run out. I can't take a bath. I have to go and borrow a bathtub. We don't have any hot water anyway.
I don't think any human being ought to live in that building, and I'm sorry that you have to live there.
There's a suggestion that there are what are called after-hour clubs in the building. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes, it does. It's a place that you sell whiskey after the bar is closed, and so far we have two in this building. And they're run by the custodian.
The proprietor of a business in the Huff area explained how urban renewal programs, as they now exist, are ineffective.
To begin with, we buy a warmed-over business in a warmed-over neighborhood, an area that has deteriorated to the point that the previous merchants have decided it's no longer to their advantage to stay there, so they sell out to some Negroes trying to move a step up the ladder.
Is your business in an urban renewal area?
Urban destruction area. It's killing my business. All they've done down there in the matter of urban renewal is chase the people over into Glenville and the other areas to make slums out of there, tear down a few houses, make the streets more deserted, fewer people, and more vulnerable for hoodlums. As for urban renewal, it's a joke. I think the principal need now, from what I get from my friends. I don't call them customers anymore because it's gotten down to the point where all I have left is friends. Customers are gone. The friends want homes. This is the primary need. These educational programs, CAY, not casting any reflections or anything, but programs are beautiful. But when you take a child for 4 or 5 hours and clean his teeth and brush his mind up and send him back to a pig pen, you haven't done anything. Because that dirt and filth and squalor is still there. And when you send that kid back out where he's got to go out in the street just to get a little relief from the rest of the family, you're not doing anything with these programs. The need is housing.
Three expert witnesses described the personal effects of segregated housing. They were a building inspector, a commission investigator, and the professional director of the Regional Church Planning Office.
And I appreciate what this committee is trying to do, and I'm glad it's finally come to a point where people realize that housing is as important as eating.
Put another way, can people be helped to escape from a state of chronic poverty without first meeting their food, clothing, shelter, and medical care needs in a way which preserves self-respect?
If you move into a neighborhood, and as you move in, you see people moving out because you moved in, I think this cannot help but have some effect on you personally. I think that if you move into an area and you see this becoming an all-Negro community very quickly, this cannot help but have some effect on one's self-esteem. I think there are many Negroes, in fact, I know there are many Negroes who are seeking to live in biracial communities and find that this is almost impossible because as they move, the ghetto moves with them. There's been practically no new housing available to Negroes. The areas out of which Negroes are moving are areas in which the housing is in very poor physical condition. I don't think this is possible for the city of Cleveland to solve the problems growing out of segregation by itself. I think that a major share of the responsibility rests with the suburban communities and their willingness to receive people regardless of race and regardless of other economic considerations.
What are the housing economics of the slum family? The testimony of two housewives from the Huff area provided the shocking answer.
Mrs. Dugan, how many rooms are there in your apartment?
Three.
And how much rent do you pay for that?
$60.
How big are these rooms?
I have one large room, a small room, and a very small room, which is the kitchen. It's very small.
Do all the rooms have windows?
No, I only have windows in one room.
Well, when the bathroom fixtures caught on fire, I called the fire department, and they came in, and they told me they should have cut it all off because it was dangerous. But I told them that I had a child that was ill, so they left it on for me. But they left the two live wires there, and they told me to call the landlord. So I called the custodian and told him to call the landlord. She said that she couldn't get in touch with the landlord, so she got angry because I kept calling over there, but it didn't make sense for me to stay there and never know when the house was going to catch on fire.
Even the effort of an interested citizens group had no effect in making more responsible landlords out of some who profiteer in slum housing. One of the citizen investigators is the next witness.
What were some of the conditions that you found in the Alhambra?
We found that bathtubs stopped up. We found that the toilets in many cases were stopped up. We found that the ceiling was, plaster was falling out of the ceiling. We found chandeliers hanging in the ceiling that was shorted, naked wires. We found that there was rats, roaches. We found the garbage chutes was plugged up. We found that there was old bedding, storage under the back porch, no furniture. We found that there was refrigerators and other debris in the basement. We found that there was wildcats living in the basement. We found that there was open sewage in the basement. We found that one family was living in the building.
supposed to have been punished did not have a stove, nor did they have a refrigerator. It was 11 members of this family. One was, they had a newborn baby who was about three or four days old. The lady did not have facilities to prepare the food for her family. She had to go upstairs to a neighbor and use their stove. She didn't even have a refrigerator to storage her milk for her newborn baby. She had to go next door. Found many conditions in there that was completely, in our judgment, unsanitary.
Mr. Russell, did you and the tenants complain to the landlord about these conditions which you found in the Alhambra?
I did not. The landlord refused to discuss the matter with us, with the Freedom Party, that is. A representative, the chairman of the committee, had made several attempts to contact the landlord and discuss these problems and perhaps to try and make some arrangements so that these problems could be alleviated. I understand the Housing Commission did make an investigation. They did not make their investigation available to us, but it was published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The Health and Sanitary and the Fire Department, I believe, found some 48 violations in the few buildings that they investigated, and therefore a condemnation sign was posted.
How is the city supposed to ensure the safety of its residents through building code enforcement? And how does Cleveland measure up in the inner city? The answers came from a member of the City of Cleveland Building Department.
Well, then there are about 6,000 or 7,000 known buildings without the certificates of occupancy. Is that correct?
Yes, there are that were not issued. Those properties, of course, are in various stages of pending action.
And that's why these buildings do not have certificates of occupancy?
Well, a certificate of occupancy will not be issued until such time as they meet code compliance.
So there are a substantial, almost 7,000 multiple dwellings in the city of Cleveland without these certificates?
Approximately.
Have you ever closed down a building because of the failure of the owner to obtain a valid certificate of occupancy?
Not to my knowledge.
I followed the interrogation from Dean Griswold. You turn it over to someone like this law enforcement and nothing happens, generally. In other words, you said earlier that not a single owner was closed down. And we had a meeting at the White House a few weeks ago, and it was said very clearly on this question of housing. It was said very clearly that as long as owners can get away with things like this, as long as they can make it profitable, it seems to me that as long as this can go on, all the inspection in the world isn't going to solve it. By golly, if you run a house that isn't fit for human habitation, it gets closed and you get put in jail or something similar.
One of the members of the commission spoke about his own visits to examine living conditions in Cleveland. He was Father Hesburgh.
I visited three houses in this city. One was the Alhambra in Chillon. One was the Clevelander. Third one was apartment up the house from the Clevelander where Mrs. Dolan lived, testified here Saturday. And I'd just like to say for the record that I've seen better pig pens.
The plans of urban renewal and public housing have been offered as answers in the housing field. But there's been a lack of clarity and direction in local projects, as reflected in this exchange between Dr. Rankin and a member of the Urban Renewal Department staff.
Mr. Friedman, you mentioned the gap, as you call it, between public housing and standard private housing. I judge you mean that there's too little public housing to meet the need and there's too much private housing that is indecent, and that you don't have in that gap between them adequate private capital to build low rent housing. Is that right?
That's a very complicated question.
Then Father Hesburgh pointed to the immorality of inadequate relocation planning for displaced persons.
Would you agree with me, and this is the last question I have, that it's in a sense immoral for the authorities in any metropolitan area that have the authority to do so to put people out of their houses before there's adequate provision made for them to get houses within their means and at least as decent as that which they are leaving, or preferably better. Would you agree with me that that's an immoral practice?
Yes, certainly there's a degree of immorality about this.
Other dimensions of welfare problems and ghetto life come into focus. Inadequate diet, inadequate welfare payments, and banking problems. From a young lad named Sam came the story of meager meals and sometimes hunger. And from a ghetto mother, the problems of getting adequate medical care.
Are rats a real problem in your neighborhood?
Yes, my sister's still living in the same building, and the rats are jumping up and down. The kids are, they play with rats like a child would play with a dog or something.
Sam, would you tell us what your mother gives you to eat toward the end of the month when your food stamps run out?
Well, mostly we eat, rice and sometimes beans.
Do you feel that you get enough to eat at this time of the month?
No.
You ever go hungry?
Sometimes.
Sam, what school do you attend?
Harry Davis.
That's the junior high?
Yes.
Mrs. Plummer, in the months before your children were born, when you were pregnant, were you able to get doctor's care?
Yes.
Where did you get it?
Well, for two of my children, I had to go over to City Hospital.
Where is that located?
On Sheridan, on the west side. And it took me an hour and a half to go there and an hour and a half to come back.
And was there one bus that took you there, or did you have to?
Three
buses. And when you arrived at the hospital, were you taken care of as soon as you came, or did you have to wait?
I had to wait.
And are you able to provide an adequate diet for all of your children at this time of the month, for example?
No, you are. Even milk, which is so essential to a child's diet, has to go.
You give them a substitute for milk?
Sometimes you can't even afford the substitute.
Well, the banks will not cash an ABC check. You can't get a cash unless you have a bank account. And I'm quite sure none of us have bank accounts. So you have to go to these same stores that you buy groceries to get them cash.
Is our national policy for welfare children, for ABC children, to be the development of new programs which attempt to compensate for the federally underwritten poverty we impose upon them? Or must we, in addition, come to grips with the reality that one simply cannot educate, inadequately fed, inadequately clothed, inadequately housed children, and that education and social services, no matter how effective or imaginative, are no substitute for the physical necessities of life?
This is part two of the investigation.
I think we all recognize that education plays a peculiarly important role, the solution of the problem, or a part of the problem, with which this commission deals.
What are the conditions under which slum dwellers attended school? What kind of schools do they attend? What special problems hinder their abilities to study and make progress? A Cleveland school teacher is the first witness.
What factors do you think contribute to this low level of achievement?
Well, I think the first factor would be overcrowdedness. The school population is too large for the facility available. Number two, as I said, would be the segregated situation. Number three, I feel that the income of the parents and the conditions in which the children have to live from day to day. And I feel also that the ideals and the lack of self-respect affects the achievement of the children. The serious problems, I feel, are more psychological than they are physical problems. They come from broken homes, they come from wealthier families, ABC families, and so forth, and they seem to be depressed by their surroundings, what has happened in their surroundings.
Just what happened to cause the Collinwood High School riot of 1965? A Collinwood student gave her idea of the reasons.
I trace Collinwood's riot back a year, at least a year before that. I think that it's just an extension of the Collinwood area's attempt to remove Negroes from its schools. You remember that the year previous to that, 64, the Collinwood neighborhood had various clubs and organizations formed designed to remove the Negroes from their elementary schools. They succeeded in doing this, and three new schools were built in the Glenville area. The riot in March 18th, was a planned affair. There were rallies held on the nights before the riot. It was general knowledge around the school that these rallies were being held and that they were attended by adults as well as by students. And one thing that impressed me about that week's events is that they were very well planned. Everything clicked very nicely. And I think that the attitude of the neighborhood, that this is their school, that Negroes have no right to attend the school, Negroes have no right to attend their Y, Negroes have no right in their area at all.
Is there still much tension in the school?
Yes, there's a great deal of tension in the school. And there's traditionally a Collinwood and Negro section of the lunchroom. Recently, the Negro section has expanded, and that's the way Negroes measure the growth of Negroes in the school, by how many tables we occupy at each period. Feelings are still tense, and I think that we could very well have a repetition of last spring's events.
How can young people act to overcome interracial tension? Howard, who is also a Collinwood student, gave his opinion.
I think young people should encourage activities, interracial activities, participate more in their school life, since they're in contact more with Negro students in school instead and not out of school. White students, I know from the Collinwood area, have based their opinions upon their parents' opinions. Most of the resentment comes from the home.
Paul Briggs, superintendent of schools, confirms the opinion of these students.
I probably have talked with more people than anyone else about the Collinwood situation. I had to use 200 policemen one day to open the school. I was there personally. I think that the problems were not necessarily inherent in the school or in the student body. These kids had a lot of help. I think the fact that 36 adults were picked up one day for questioning, for examination, and for de-arming that were in the vicinity of the school is an indication of some adult help that was being given to children.
A staff psychologist testifies on the causes of the dropout problem, the interconnection between job opportunities and staying in school.
They see what jobs they will or will not be able to get. They see the futility of even the training programs that are offered them because they know that the jobs that they will then, that they will be trained to do will not be available to them in unions or in business. They see themselves as cornered, and they see the school as, in a sense, a mockery of the society rather than a reflection of its best attributes. And this kind of attitude, I think, is particularly northern. It has not yet reached the South, and it may never reach the South.
The psychologist's testimony concluded with a report about the high degree of psychological damage among Negro children in the Cleveland schools. This damage was far greater than any he had tested in the South. The next expert witness dealt with the problems of de facto segregation and the school board's role in resolving these problems, as well as other school inadequacies that were observed.
The first is that in any city where de facto segregation exists, the school board has to recognize that its educational system can play a major role in overcoming the unhappy consequences of this segregation. and they have a responsibility to do something about it. It follows that they should not be subject to the influence of or beholden to political, industrial, or real estate interests as they might interfere with its primary task. These schools are huge and ridiculously huge. They're unmanageably huge, appallingly bad, incredibly bad. If you have a large school in a very poor neighborhood, you're bound to have a lot of people who have behavioral problems as well as other problems, who are going to be exceedingly disruptive to the whole school. And the whole atmosphere in the school gets to be really rather frightful. To go into a school and find teachers walking around with walkie-talkies in order to control, and I was going to say control the mob, but after all, what do you use walkie-talkies for?
Superintendent Briggs testified as to his findings when he joined the Cleveland system in 1964.
Also, I found a school system that was racially unbalanced. And tonight is more racially unbalanced than what it was 2 years ago. You can't have the kind of flight of the white middle-class people to suburbia and have racial balance. As far as location of schools to get integration, this can't be done in Cleveland, to my judgment. As far as state support for the budget of the Cleveland public schools are concerned, of the 12 largest cities in the United States, Cleveland ranks number 12 in the percent of her budget that comes from state sources. As far as finances are concerned, we're going out after more money. In this fall election, there will be on the ballot a request for more funds for the Cleveland public schools. We are asking the state legislature to consider new ways of developing new patterns of state support that will remedy the situation that now exists in this state. It is inequitable. Let me give you one example. The seventh wealthiest city in America is a suburb of Cleveland. That city has the same tax rate as the city of Cleveland, the total taxes. Less than a fraction of a mill different. The city schools of that city have $880-some-odd to spend per child, while Cleveland has $417. The state of Ohio gives that school system gross $93 per year, and city of Cleveland $91 per year.
Per student.
Per student, yes. I'm sorry. If there's one thing that the civil rights movement has done, it has focused a very strong light on the needs of the big city. And this has been good.
We go on to the area of employment. Evidence showed that even the training programs to prepare the unemployed for skilled work were not always adequate.
We heard evidence this morning that there was a program not long ago on electric motor repair, that it was held in a room which was never properly wired during the term of the course, and that there was not the equipment which was needed except as the instructor brought in some pieces. Whose responsibility was that there were these deficiencies?
If there were such deficiencies, the responsibility is the public school system.
Well, who on behalf of the employment agency had any responsibility to take steps to see that the course was adequately conducted?
We in the Public Employment Service do not have this responsibility under the law.
This is federal money that is being expended on your recommendation. You apparently originate the training course, but then wash your hands of it.
What is the job situation for the inner city resident? A personnel director for a large suburban company provided the answer.
Can you estimate how many skilled and semi-skilled job openings there are presently in the Cleveland area?
My best estimate would be around 7,000 to
8,000 people in the skilled and semi-skilled levels. We have in our corporation, or in our plant in Euclid, an on-the-job program. We currently have around 1,100 people enrolled in it. This is training at the workstation for people who are recently hired and people who have been recently upgraded.
I believe you said that in the next year you're going to hire about 1,100 more.
Yes, our requirements show about 1,183 more. With our current turnover rate, which is running around 3% per month, we will need an additional 2,000 people to stay even, so our total employment looks like about 2,300 to 2,400. This includes the employment of people to handle the turnover rate. I think one reason why we have had success with the MDTA graduates is that we have recognized the skill levels that they come to us with. And in our plant, we have a 90-day training program for all MDTA graduates. After we hire them, and we hire them as trainees for a 90-day period, they receive additional schooling in the plant plus on-the-job training. And I think because of this, we've recognized that they come to us with a good basic foundation, and for this reason, I think we've been successful.
The participating cause of many riots has been a police incident, growing out of a long history of bad police community incidents.
Well, if you call a policeman in my area, they might come out, they may not. And you have to wait from 2 to 5 hours. You can't find a policeman when you want him. I walked one night from 93rd to 79th. And during that time, I didn't see a policeman at all.
Does the slum dweller get the same kind of police protection as the suburbanite? Mrs. Dugan said no. And a public defender felt that inner city residents are likely to be picked up on suspicion with more frequency and less discretion than others.
Holding for detention is in fact an arrest. Would you agree with that?
Certainly is.
Is there any basis for a view as a matter of law that a person can be held for 72 hours without a charge and without an opportunity to use a telephone?
Absolutely not. Ohio statutory law alone would prohibit this without even the United States Constitution having.
Why do you think this practice is taken for granted in the Cleveland Police Department?
Well, necessity sometimes is what is claimed to be the reason. We have to have time to investigate. The investigation begins on arrest, rather than the investigation having been completed by the time of arrest.
Is there any proper legal basis for the arrest of a person, quote, on suspicion, close quote?
Absolutely not.
Is there such a legal charge or crime as being a suspicious person?
Well, there is that offense in Cleveland.
Police Chief Richard Wagner also admitted that persons might sometimes be held for longer than 24 hours or even 72 hours without even being allowed to make a phone call.
How long may such a person be detained in the police station without being formally charged with a crime?
For a reasonable length of time, which is the length of time that it would take to thoroughly investigate the matter.
Can you give us some rough idea about how long this period of detention averages?
I have no idea of how long it averages because it depends upon the circumstances in each individual case.
Do you have a maximum period of time for which a person can be held for?
We have set no maximum because we have never, there are some cases of such peculiar difficulty that we couldn't set a maximum. The maximum has been set, we believe, by the statute, says a reasonable length of time.
So are there people that are sometimes held longer than 72 hours?
It has happened.
Is it ever possible that someone would be held 24 hours without being allowed to make a telephone call?
I would say that Again, it might happen in certain cases because of the nature of the case. I'm trying to leave out all of these excuses you've referred to. The typical case of a man who wants to use the telephone because he's been arrested. Now, how long does he have to wait to use the telephone?
I cannot answer the question, sir.
But what I'm trying to get at is when he can make that telephone call. And if I may say so, it seems to me you're very evasive in answering that question. When is he entitled to make that telephone call?
Well, sir, the only way answer I'd give is that he's entitled to make it immediately according to the law.
These have been glimpses through testimony into the five or six major areas of the commission investigation. There were summary statements from a variety of community leaders asking that the testimony be given serious attention as the basis for improving Cleveland ghetto life.
We in Cleveland have developed the art of accenting the positive to the exclusion of remedying the negatives. How difficult it is, but necessary, to advocate to you as one of our own local remedies the accent of the negative. Because I know not how else to strike at and endeavor to dispel the deep, almost indigenous, false sense of security and accomplishment that pervades this city.
I cannot for the life of me understand why the life of our cities is not considered an emergency issue. It is my hope that the commission's coming will finally convince the city leadership of Cleveland that problems do indeed exist. And perhaps that will mean that without the aid of demonstrations and crises, we will find solutions. Thank you.
Instead of solutions, riots came to Cleveland. But many of the conditions described still exist.